and what a pleasure with the meet and all relaxed, and the circus is leaving town.
Yeah, I'm actually glad. I'm looking forward to a little time off and relax. But tell you what, we were talking about earlier, and I double-checked with Scott, the races secretary, and Saturday we actually handled 19.2 million,
wow,
which was, I think, the second highest ever. The all-time records, I think, just over 20 million.
Well, I mean, I've been gushing all morning about what a fabulous day it was. You had a mammoth crowd, for starters.
Big crowd. Oh, no, standing room only. You're right. And the clubhouse was sold out. All the little waitresses, the little Campo girl that works down where we clock from, she was bragging. She said, oh, this would be my big day. And I think she made $1,000, she told us.
Oh, that's great.
So I said, well, you need it, because a lot of times there's nobody in here.
And, if you know, Mike, it's such a weird dynamic, because, I mean, you've seen, you know, the greatest days probably of the game, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s, the old building here. Everybody says to me, were you ever here for the old building? And everybody just loved the old building. But this town and this track has a real place in the community. And they come out for the big days.
Thanksgiving Day has always been like a mainstay here in New Orleans area. People just went to the racetrack on Thanksgiving Day. You had your Thanksgiving dinner, and then you came out here, and had another dinner. But and you know, when Brian rebuilt this track, he knew that the landscape had changed where very few tracks have big everyday attendance on track because of the internet and the betting, and you know, you can see it and watch it on television now and everything. So he deliberately built a smaller plant than what we had originally. The original plant was enormous, and it was so unique because that back in those days everybody had a certain section that they stayed in. And if you wanted to look for somebody, you knew where to go find them because that's where they would be. And the clubhouse was on the left side of the track when the separate, and it was just one long flat clubhouse. It wasn't a tiered clubhouse like we have now. So you could walk through there and you talk before you get to the windows to go bet. You stopped at five or six tables talking to people. And it just was a really, really fun building to be around. And we, you know, we had a great time in it. Now, and it just, you know, one of those things with a faulty electrical system out of the jocks room. And next thing you know, they were chasing the fire. And that was one of the craziest things because Brian and Vicky called me and Brent, we came out here, and the fire hadn't got to the main building yet. It was coming across the paddock, and they had a new fire chief and everything and a new crew in New Orleans at that time. And instead of, if all they had to do was come to where the grandstands was and start putting the water there and firing the fire from that way, instead they chased the fire, and it went all the way through the grandstands. We had Lou Hodges, the track photographer, sure. Well, his daddy, Mr. Lou, he had 6,000 or 7,000 negatives from all kind of famous races and over the years. And we had up on the fifth floor, it was a museum room where we have a timeline now, but a lot of the stuff we had saved up there and stuff that we'd change out, you know, exhibits and stuff, and all kind of pictures. And Black Hat Lacombe, he was a track publicity director for 30 years out here, and he had a deal where he had these big giant scrapbooks. And back in the 60s and 70s, the Saints didn't show up till 67. So horse racing and boxing were the kings in New Orleans. And we'd have 3 and 4 articles every day in the Picayune, and they had 2 newspapers too, States Item and the Picayune. And he'd cut all the articles out and put them in these books and label the dates and everything.
Clip books.
And we had dozens of those books. I mean, like during the off season, Mervyn Muniz, who was the racing secretary here and director of racing for many years, he'd say, "Mike, you got it." Because me and Brent were like custodians of the museum room, and he said, "Yeah, come on, let's go up there and go through the books." And we'd go up there and we'd sit there for 2 hours, you know, during the off season. And you had your little bit of work you had to do, putting a publicity media guide together and different things, and then we'd go up there and sitting, and I mean, it was amazing, some of the great articles and stuff that you would read that, you know, happened at the racetrack and all. So, you know, you know, a lot of history was lost in that fire. And we wanted to go up there because Brian and Vicky had called us. So, yeah, we'll go get the negatives and much of the other stuff that you can get and come down, because it was, the fire wasn't even halfway to where that is. And the fire marshal said, no one's allowed in the building because they have gas lines running through the entire building. And if one went off, it might blow up the whole building. So on safety. And because of that, way on the other end in the clubhouse was the old Metairie painting, which you see a copy of it down on the fourth floor. That spent 2 years in the Smithsonian Institute on exhibit for racing in, you know, in the 1880s. And they could have got that out easily. And
nobody
was allowed in the building. Oh, and it ended up burning up and ended up losing it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. And you know what? Tom Amos was the first. It was amazing. You talk about the Jazz Fest. In fact, if you're going to be here later,
they're going to move in.
They're starting to move in. They got truckloads of furniture, wood and everything, and that's all going to be in the infield by tomorrow morning because they set up unbelievable how they work and set up. And because of the connection with the Jazz Fest and the fairgrounds that Brian had, place burnt down. And 19 days later, we were running races here at the fairgrounds as they had to go to Belgium and have it flown into Houston because our airport wasn't big enough to get this big, giant, like tents they use for circuses and stuff. And that whole parking lot on this end, all the way to the top of the stretch, was a big, giant tent, and that was our grandstand. And then we had some trailers in the back. And then at the top of the stretch, they had a temporary building, they made a little small shack, and that was the racing secretary's office. And we actually ran races for the rest of the meet and got through it because of Quint Davis and the Jazz Fest people. We had all those connections, and they were able to – I mean, at the finish line, they took three of those canisters. It's stuff that they put waste in and buried, and it was metal containers. And they stacked three on top of each other at the finish line. And the bottom row was for the press box. The middle one was for cameras and stuff, and then the top ones were just the stewards and the announcer. And
who was announcing that?
Tony Bentley. Tony Bentley was.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Tony was the announcer, and the stewards. You just laughed. The cinders were still smoldering. Some behind us with the burning built with the building. You know, a week and two later, and yeah, they had our houses there. That's all they had down there. And the poor stewards. It was like going on a ship. You had to go up and climb down that way because it was so steep. And they said, man, this is getting old. But, hey, we got through the meet, and I ended up, you know, being another successful meet that year.
there's more. I won't say there's more stories to be told about not just fairgrounds either, but Jefferson Downs.
Jefferson Downs. Oh, Jefferson Downs was I worked there. Forever. I worked there back in 1972. I was a senior in high school, and that was my summer job working for Black Cat at Jefferson Downs. And believe me, Black Cat Lacombe, he was a Damon Runyon character, and he was a good guy and the best hustler you ever saw in your life. I mean, I used to love working in the press box up in the fairgrounds because he'd hustle all of the riders. Whenever they won a stake race, oh, you got to send up 50 pounds of crawfish to the press box, you know, and after the races, we all have, you know, eat crawfish and drink beer and have fun up in the fair. And Broadview Joe was a horse owner. He owned Broadview Seafood right around the block on Broad Street, right off of Jeff, 2 minutes from here. And he'd bring the hot ball crawfish, and the jocks would get it in the jocks room too. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, the press box, but he hit Black Cat. He was a good hustler. He'd hustle them all the time.
Well, and your dad.
My dad, you know, he grew up loving horse racing. I mean, horse racing was in his blood because my grandfather loved horse racing. My grandfather worked in the advertising department for the Times-Picayune, and he'd knock off at 12 o'clock, get most of his work done. Some of it he could do over the phone, you know, guys that he had good relationship with and all. And he'd come out, but he'd have to go on the backside because he wouldn't want anybody to see him out here because you're supposed to be at work, you know. So he had his group of guys he hung out. And back in those days, Belford Street, which is splits the barn area right behind us, nothing but bookmakers. They had bookmakers. Every other house had a book. It was a booking shop. And so my daddy had that in his blood from a long time. And I tell you what, I'm laughing. I'll tell you a couple of funny stories that, you know, it almost reminds you of stuff like in the movies with the sting and stuff and all.
Yeah.
My daddy, he's going to Jesuit High School. He's a senior at Jesuit High School. So this is 1948. He's a senior at Jesuit High School. He's a copy boy in the afternoons at the Picayune. Well, Bill Keith was the sports editor for the Times Picayune, and he loved horse racing. In fact, when he came out, he ran the show. He'd tell the stewards what was going on. They had all the, I guess back in those days, newspapers were really strong. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of TV and all of that coverage. So my grandfather would always knock off, you know, at 12 o'clock. Well, he'd go right there on Jefferson Highway. Jefferson Highway was wide open. They had gambling casinos and bookie shops, and they had the boards by Pat Gillins. Ron Gillin, who came out, was a good friend of mine. That was his daddy. And they had Pat Gillins on Jefferson Highway right down from Osher Hospital, where he is now. And they'd had the book, you know, the board, and they'd give the calls and all. So my daddy would get the car, and he'd drop my grandfather off and go to the Picayune to work. And then when he got off at 6 o'clock, he'd come back and pick up my grandfather, and they would live 5 minutes away from Pat Gillins, where we lived. They lived off of Jefferson Highway. So he comes to pick up my grandfather up, and my grandfather says, "Oh, no, wait a couple minutes. They're getting ready to run the such-and-such race at this track. I got a bet on so-and-so." He says, "What race?" He says, "This race right here, number seventh race." He goes, "No, that ran 5.46. Your horse didn't do nothing." "What are you talking about? They didn't run it yet. They're getting ready to give the call." He says, "I pulled it off the AP wire before I left when I was walking out the door, and I seen that race result was the last one on the list. It had just finished." And it was only like 3 or 4 minutes from where he worked to go to where the book looked like. So sure enough, they give the call and run the race, and he was right. But he says, "Man," he says, "huh, I got the race results before they put them up on the board." He says, so he gets John Pettibon, who was Richie Pettibon, who was with the Redskins and all, was sure. Best friends, and my daddy. Well, John was his older brother. He was in the same class with my daddy. In fact, Albert Stahl, who was the racing commissioner here, Moon Landrieu, who was mayor forever, my daddy, John Pettibon, all in the same class at Jesuit. So he gets together, and he gets John, he gets Lou Boda, and he gets Rooster Laporte, who ended up being a mutual clerk out here for years. And he tells him, "Look," he says, "we might have a chance to make a few dollars. These are all 18-year-old seniors at Jesuit High School." He says, "I'll be at the Picayune, and you go to this place, and get to where you can get to a pay phone, and I'll call you when we get a horse that pays a decent price, and you can run in and make a bet on it." He says, "What you do is you bet, you know, $2, because they didn't have a lot of money in those days, $2, but you make a couple other bets on a couple other races for $2, because, you know, you don't want them to think, you know, you're just doing something, because all of a sudden you got a $30 horse, and so they do this, and they win for about 3 weeks in a row. They all cut up a few hundred dollars, and so they're cutting it up, and Rooster had a lady that was in the parlor every day, and she would be betting 10s and 20s, and she was a big customer. So he said, "Can you make this bet for me?" And she'd go bet the 10 or 20 for him. So he only had to bet two on the other ones, but she'd get him down for 10 or 20. So they come back. So my daddy, the Beverly Dinner Playhouse was a big casino right off on Jefferson Highway, right by River Road. And the bosses of there knew my daddy and my grandfather and all of them. And one day they bump into him, and the guy says, "Oh, buddy," he says, "you're good friends with John Pettibon, huh?" He says, "Oh, yeah, it's one of my best friends." He says, "Man, you know, he starts coming in our joint betting on some horses." He says, "He never did that before, and we seem like he's doing something, but we can't figure out what he's doing." He says, "But, you know," so he says, "Well, I'll talk to him about it." So he goes and talks to John. He says, "John, you making something suspicious? What's going on at the place?" He says, "Well, no, I just go in and make the bets." He said, "What you been betting?" He says, "Well, I'll bet 50 cents, 50 cents, 50 cents. And then when you call me, I bet $10. He says, "Well, John, I told you, you gotta bet the same amount every time." He says, "Yeah, but buddy, I couldn't take myself to bet more than 50 cents if I didn't know it already won." He says, "Oh, that, you know, you can't do that anymore. We gotta get in trouble." So then they come to settle up, you know, at the end of the week, and they're settling up, and John's $10 short. He said, "Well, John, you're $10 short." He says, "Yeah, I was feeling real guilty, and I went to confession, and I told the priest what we were doing." He said, and the priest asked me, he said, "Well, if the bookmakers had one of those AP machines, could they get the same results as you got? And he said, well, yeah, they, if they had one of the machines, they can get it. He said, well, okay, well, then it's okay. Put $10 in the pool box and say five Hail Marys and five Our Fathers. And then he says, that's it. That's it. But then about a week later, Bruce and them got busted with it, and then it ended up, you know, cutting it off. But and I tell you, that was the days when that kind of stuff went
on. Sure, a little past posted.
I tell you another one. This is true fact. I think a lot of people and historians knew Huey Long was a big governor here, and might even have been a vice president if he wouldn't have got assassinated. Well, his brother Earl Long became governor of Louisiana. Well, he loved the horses, you know. And back in those days, Jefferson Highways, like I said, was wide open. Well, in order for them not to crack down and shut it down, Earl Long would have a $20 win bet on the last winner at the fairgrounds every day. So they always, the bookmakers always pulling for the favorite to win the last race. To make a long story short, fairgrounds closes and Oak Lawn Park is open. So Bill Keith is the racing sports editor. He tells my daddy's a copy boy. So he says, look, buddy, I'm going on vacation for a week. I got to give you one assignment that you got to do every day. He says, okay, what's that, sir? He says, get the Oak Lawn result, because he knew my daddy knew the horses and knew what he was talking about with the horses. Get the results at Oak Lawn Park. Go in my office at 4 o'clock. Close the door. And at 4 o'clock, the governor's going to call him. Wants the results at Oak Lawn Park. This is 1948. So he says, okay. He says, so my daddy says, the governor of what? He says, the governor, Earl Long, the governor. Oh, the governor's going to call. He says, okay. So first day comes, he gives, the phone rings, 4 o'clock, gives him all the results. Next day, same thing, goes in, yes, sir, and gives all the results. Well, the third day comes, and the guy that's running the editorial until Big Keith gets back, the assistant, says, oh, buddy, we need you to go down to such and such and pick up this stuff. We need it, you know, in the next couple hours. He says, well, no, I can't go right now. It's 10 minutes to 4. I got to be in Mr. Keith's office at 4 o'clock. I said, Mr. Keith's on vacation. He ain't there. He said, no, I got to be in his office to talk, to get the results to the governor. And at that time, they had a lot of scandals going on, and governor wasn't talking to anybody. He was, you know, incommunicado. So this guy says, you mean Earl Long is going to call on this phone wanting results from Oak Lawn Park? He says, yeah, I gave them to him the first 2 days. He's real nice. He says, you go do what I told you. I'll give him the results. So he goes in, and the governor calls. He says, oh, yeah, governor, this was so-and-so. Buddy had to go on a, you know, but I'll take care of you. He gives him the first two races. Then when it comes time for the third, well, governor, what about this? Well, governor has to answer to get the next one. Next thing you know, headlines, exclusive interview with Governor Earl Long in the Picayune. Because he wanted the horse races so bad. He wanted the results. So, man, believe me, it was wide open back in the 40s and 50s down here.
Well, that's part of the absolute legacy you got going here. And all, you know, you come down this hall and all these tremendous pictures. And actually, I got to ask you, I've got a terrific suggestion from Frank about Frenchie Schwartz and
Frenchie Schwartz
teaching you how to. But I also, when I said I was coming down, John Parada, John said to me, if you're going to New Orleans, he said, ask about Pickle Nose Willie.
Pickle Nose Willie, hell, one of the top handicappers around. Captain Maestri, Lloyd Maestri, was a figure man, and he would always give you his figures when I was first coming around the racetrack. And he was best friends with me and Mervin and all. And in fact, Louis Roussel named the horse after him, and then Neil Peston ended up naming the horse after him. But neither one turned out anything special. But he knew Pick'em Wells really well and said he was one of the top handicappers in the country. And, yeah, Lloyd would have his figures, and you know, but they had a lot of characters. I mean, we laugh. Lloyd tells us a story. He said he would go with the Turk, and they'd go to Detroit. When the fairgrounds closed, they'd go to Detroit, and he was the Turk's handicapper. So said they go out in the mornings and they watching the horses and timing them and figuring out. Then they come back to the hotel. Said they come back and they hit the elevator, open up, and here comes Bill Hartack. He's stumbling. He's like he's been out all night drinking. And the captain goes, huh, he's got 8 mouths today. put a line through them. He won't get nothing. He says, he only went five that day. he says, I guess he died. And then later on, Bill Hartack became a steward here at the fairgrounds. And he was a character. Now, I'll tell you what, he was a pretty sharp guy. And he didn't hold no punches. He told them riders listened to him pretty good. One time we asked him about, horses, about when they stood up, the duck stood up and he ended up winning the Derby. We said, do you think he still would have won if he wouldn't have stood up? He says, only one person can answer that question. The rider on the other horse.
Shoemaker.
He says, Shoemaker would be the only one that could tell you the truth. Because if you ride horses enough like we do, some horses, when you ease off, they immediately slow down.
Right.
Some of them takes them, a 16th of a mile before they slow down. So if he's the one that immediately slows down, yeah, that probably cost him the race. If he's the other kind, he might have still, he still might have got beat,
We're talking the 57 Derby and Gallant Man.
Yeah.
And I asked Nehrud about it, about the incident, and Nehrud said, when I went out on the apron, when he came back, and I said to myself, if he doesn't apologize first thing and take the blame first thing, he said, Shoemaker came back and said, I'm sorry, boss. He said, I missed it. I missed it. And Iron Liege.
Oh, yeah.
And Hartack for Calumet. And, of course, Calumet had lost General Duke Friday.
Yeah. Well, that, in fact, Bill Hartack told me, when we asked him, going into the Derby, what horse do you think was the one that you had the best shot of winning with?
General Duke.
General Duke was the answer. He said, General Duke's a monster, but he got hurt before. I would have been the most confident going in with that race, he said, with that horse. He said that. Yeah.
And he won it anyway.
Oh, no, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, right. He won it anyway, but, it just goes to show you.
Yeah, no. So it's what and widely considered the best crop of horses in racing history. Round Table,
oh no,
Bold great. Ruler, Gallant Man, Clem, Barbizon. It's a litany. It's unbelievable.
The league goes on. Many turned out to be champion, not only race horses but stallions and everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Round Table.
You mentioned Eugene Swenchy. Eugene Swenchy Schwartz was the head clocker for the racing farm for 50 years. And then he had a brother named Alphonse who was a trainer. They complete opposites. Swenchy was in New York for all them years and all. And, so he was kind of by the rules and by the things. And Alphonse was a trainer. And Alphonse, believe me, he clocked with us at Jefferson, me and Billy Pettengill, at Jefferson Downs for like 6 years. He's retired, and he wanted something to do. So he was clocking horses there. In fact, he come up with Gene. He called Gene. He said, man, I got a horse over here at Jefferson Downs. Donnie Winfrey had a horse. Donnie's good truck.
The greatest.
He was the clock here for us, but he's still clocking horses up at Churchill.
With John.
Well, Philly name, No Joke. Well, Donnie had left early the year before, so Mervin and them didn't give him stalls. They made him go to Jefferson Downs and ship over. So he was over at Jefferson Downs. Well, Alphonse calls up Gene. He says, man, he says, you got a horse that just worked 11 and change over here. He says, nobody works better than 14. He says, this also win. So Gene, I was working, I'm 19 years old, working in the press box with Alan Lacombe and keeping the statistics and stuff. And Gene Schwartz was always up, and I'd run his bets for him. And they believe me, it was a life learning experience working in the press box at that young age. Leaping Lou Messina was a boxing promoter. He was up there every day betting the horses. They had all kind of characters that would come in and out. Well, Gene walks over to me. Now, usually he bets, $5, $10. He comes over to me and he gives me five $100 bills. He says, "Here, go bet this $500 on this horse." I said, $500. I said, this is in the 70s. I said, okay.
Might as well be 10,000.
First flash is 4 to 5. Yeah. And she ended up going off even money and winning by 12.
Wow. I've heard that.
She ended up being a multiple stakes winner.
Yeah, we've heard Don talk about, absolutely. Don's talked about, no joke.
Yeah, but Alphonse, some of the stories he'd tell you, Steve, you just laugh. Me and Billy had so much fun. And Gary Palmisano would come sit in the clocker stand because when it got to be about 9:15, things really slowed down and we still had to stay open to 10. And he'd come in and Frenchie would start telling stories. He says, The Barreras, you know, the Barreras. I said, yeah, Laz Barrera and Angel, because Angel was down here. He lived down here. And he says, because of me, they're all in this country. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, he says, Angel was the only one. He's the oldest, and he was the only one in the country. Well, I had some horses, and back in those days, he says, you know, you had to give them a race in and cash a bet because the purses were so small. So it was coming to the end of the meet, and we've been holding a horse and getting him ready for a race, and I had a couple of Cuban grooms and stuff and all. Well, they tip Angel off that, you know, we're going to crack with the horse, which, you know, that's fine if he wants to bet on us. But he gets somebody to claim a horse.
Ooh.
So they claim the horse. The horse wins for fun, claim the horse, and go on and win three races in a row with him, including a little overnight stake. And that's where they got the money to bring the other.
Bring the brothers
so,
over.
So when that happened, when he found out Angel claimed the horse, he seen him in the grandstands, and he went, you money, and starts chasing him through the grandstand. So Angel runs all the way up to the steps trying to go to the stewards. He grabs him and decks him, and stewards call him in the next day. He says, Alphonse, you can't be doing stuff like this. He says, you know, we're going to have to fine you $100. And that was big money back in those days.
Yeah.
So Alphonse pulls out his wallet, and he just cashed a big bet. He pulls out his wallet money, and he throws $200 on the table. And the steward said, well, no, we told you we're finding you $100. He said, that's for the next time I see you. I said, oh, my God.
Exactly.
I believe it. Now, that was a character. He said he used to take the horses. He trained for the guy that owned one of the big supermarket magnates in Chicago. They owned like 8 or 10 stores. And he was his main trainer for them. And they'd go out to – he'd take the stable at Del Mar during the summer. And you know, and he said, that's back when you could take the horses out onto the sand and by the water and everything.
Across the street.
Before interstate and everything, you know, changed all that. And he said, yeah, he said, we, you know, we had some great times back there. I said, well, when he's in Chicago, he said, yeah, and you know, I'd even go up to Ontario and up in Canada and we'd run some horses up there. He said, what I'd do is I'd take a string of horses up there and the majority of them were the cheaper horses and we just sell them, and then I'd come back. So he says, so I'm going to sell these horses. So he says, meet's over with. We had okay meet, so I'm going to sell the 8 horses that I had, get the money. So I got, he says, I got $12,000. Then I got it in a little pouch, and I said, so I'll get me a suite on the train coming back. So we coming back in the train, and I said, man, I got a, and he said, Canadian money's a little bigger than our money. So he says, so I stuffed it all in my pillowcase and, you know, and put it on the pillow, and I'm sound asleep in the thing, and all of a sudden, I hear this loud roaring noise, and I realize the train has stopped. And I look at the watch, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning. I said, what's going on? So I look out the window, and there's all kind of people out there. So I said, well, hell. So he gets up, and he walks, you know, to the door where you get off the train, and he's looking, and he sees all the people about 40 feet, 40 yards away. So he says, well, let me go see what's going on. And this big roar and sound, he says, you can't hear it so loud. I'm wondering what they're looking at. So I go walking, and some of them start coming back. But I'm walking, so I get to where they are. Lo and behold, we're at Niagara Falls.
Niagara Falls. I knew that was coming.
He says, so we're at Niagara Falls. So he says, man, he said, that was the most beautiful. He said, I'm sitting here looking at this. Well, evidently, everybody else had been out there for 30 minutes, and now they're all getting back on the train, and I don't know it because you can't hear them saying, you know, get back on the. So he said, I'm standing there. Next thing you know, I turn around, and there goes the train, and I'm standing out in my pajamas at Niagara Falls in the middle of nowhere. He said, so I started chasing him, but I couldn't catch him. He said, then some two guys come with one of those little push carts on the train, maintenance guys. He said, I tried to flag them down, and they started to try to go fast, and I'm yelling and screaming, so finally they stopped. And I tell him what happened, and I tell him I got $12,000 in my sleeping cart. So he says, they got to the next thing and wired ahead. And he said, it took me 2 days to get back to the train, but my money was still in there. It locked the room and wouldn't let nobody in.
So tremendous.
So some of the story, I mean, we used to love just listen to the stories that he would tell us, you know.
Well, and Frenchie taught you how to clock.
Frenchie taught, boy, I tell you what, see, he had one of the old-time watches, you know, where you had to keep clicking and winding it and winding it and winding them, really good old stopwatches. In fact, his is in the Smithsonian Institute because he was the one that Tom, Secretary at Preakness, would, really was a track record when they had the malfunction. And so he had that watch, and he had put that in the Smithsonian. And he'd come sit down with, in the old building, the clock stand, they had the clock stand on the backside, but they had the one in the grandstands on the steps right here in the corner. And that was perfect view. You could see the gate perfectly, and you could just open the door and talk to the jockeys and when they're coming back. So if you weren't sure who a horse was, you could grab them and say, hey, come up with the name, you know, if you don't, so we could try to match them. And, I mean, Ronnie Lamarck used to come sit in there and watch his horses with, you know, with Louis' horses and all, and watch it. Lynn Whiting, when he had Little E.T., his daddy, he called him the Colonel. He'd come sit in with Lynn, say, can he come sit in with y'all? Because it would be out of the weather. We had a little heater in there, so when on the cold days. And Frenchie would come in there because he stayed right over here at the Park Esplanade. That's where he lived for the last 15 years of his life. He lived right there at Park Esplanade. So he'd just walk over here and come in the clocker stand, and, you know, and he'd make you pay attention. Like we want to start talking with somebody came in and he'd slap you. Pay attention to the racetrack. Pay attention to the racetrack. You know. So, but no, he was a pretty sharp guy though. But I tell you what, his brother Alphonse might have been one of the sharpest people looking at a horse that I've ever seen. We'd sit in there. And Jay Kutchie's a trainer. Jay had a horse that's a pretty good horse named One Tough Cat, and he hadn't been running as good as he had been running. And Jay said, man, Frenchie, Alphonse, I think something, I don't know, we checked him out and nobody says they can find anything wrong with him. So he's walking, he said, watch him when he comes by and watch him. So he walked him, watched him, and watched him come back. He says, I think he got something in the back end. He's a little stiff in the back end. Start working on the back end. Sure enough, a few weeks later, boom, he's back to normal, running good again. Talk another story, Gary Parmesano. At a first-time starter, and he's working and working. He's working good, and then, but man, when he comes walking back, Dick French goes, huh, look at him. He's walking on eggshells. He says, I don't want no part of him walking on eggshells. Then all of a sudden, he comes walking back one day, and French goes, damn, that's the same horse. He ain't walking on eggshells. I don't know what he did, but, oh, he looks terrific. I said, French, he's in tomorrow night. Going 4.5 at in the maiden race. Huh. Pulls out 20. Says, here, bet me 20 on him tomorrow night. Win by 14. I said, man, he was really sharp at looking at a horse, you know, with a well, I'll tell you another funny one. You talk about how they used to have to cash your bet. He's in Chicago. He's got his horses in one half of the barn and Al Capone's horses in the other half of the barn. He says, oh, nice guys, all real nice guys. So he's having a rough meet. So they got a horse they're going to cash a bet on. Well, that morning, the repo man comes to repo his car. So he tells him, you hadn't paid 3 months on this car, we're repoing it. He says, oh, man, you got to give me one more day. I'll have all the money, you know, at the end of the day and this and that. Now, and so he's walking, they're walking, he's talking as they're walking the horse in the shed road. And he's got his, you know, groom. And he tells his groom, he says, look, when we come around the second time, push him into the tack room and nail it shut. Make sure you got a hammer and nails and nail it shut. We got to keep him out of business for a few hours. So the guy comes walking by, push him into the tack room, nail the door shut, and the guy's yelling, I'll have y'all all in jail. Y'all will be in jail. You can't do this. He says, I'm a government. He says, well, we'll get you out in a few hours. The race is in a couple of hours. So the horse runs, the horse wins, they get their money. He comes back to let the guy out. I said, that's it. Y'all all going to jail. I'm going to the sheriff. So he goes to the sheriff. So they call the sheriff calls Frenchie up. Happens to be Frenchie's friends with the sheriff. The sheriff calls Frenchie.
What a coincidence.
He says, Alphonse, what did you do? So he's telling the sheriff the story. He says, I couldn't let him take my car, but I knew I'd have the money when we cashed the bet on the horse. He says, all right, Fawns, come on in, and I'll explain it to the guy. So he's telling the guy, and he gave him a fine, paid a $100 fine and this and that, and then he paid the guy that owed for the call. So everything was fine. Everything was fine after that.
So great.
I said that's stuff you see in movies, you know.
Exactly. I mean that's the appeal. That, you know, this is what it's just the color, the color is still around. Right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
It has not gone away.
Oh, they still got some characters, you know. They still got a few characters around. Not as many as they used to have, but they still got some characters, and you can find them if you're out here on a regular basis.
You know who always loved it here, and who I probably was the first person, because I've been here for Jazz Fests.
Oh, Jazz Fest is amazing.
But I'd never been here for for racing. And Bobby Frankel, right?
Bobby Frankel was really tight with Mervyn Muniz, the racing secretary.
Bobby said, you come here in November with a – come here with a lame horse. You're going to leave with a fit horse. Said this was the greatest surface to get a horse ready. And that, you know, it's funny because you guys, all of you, you all come marauding up to Louisville for Derby. And you got so many Derby stories because you're watching, you know, you're watching the great horses train and you know what's coming, 45, 60 days later.
And it's still to this day that trainers know their horses leave here ready to roll. And actually, you hate to say it, but because of pots at different racetracks, we become semi like a training center because Brad Cox and a lot of the big outfits and Asmussen, they'll train here. They'll ship over and run at Oaklawn and then bring them right back to here because the track is so, you know, so easy on the horses and all. And you laughed about Jazz Fest. One year we were up at the Derby, and Brian Krantz, Dave Milius, Joe Sherman, we're all at the table. And Brian says, he's talking on the phone. And when he hangs up, he says, yeah, he says, let's have a contest. We're going to name, you got to give a figure and a track of what track has the most on-track attendance today, which Derby Day. So we also, well, we know it's Churchill Downs, so we're giving 95,000, 99,000. Brian says, no, I'll take the fairgrounds. He says, what do you mean? He says, 105,000 at the Jazz Fest.
That's pretty good.
They pack them in for the Jazz
pretty
Fest.
Pretty good. Oh, unbelievable. Mikey Deliberto is with us, who is the head clocker here, part of just a great family of racetrackers and, you know, really a culture of racetrackers, a community. I've got all kinds of requests rolling in here. I don't know if you'll deliver on this, but there's a story about a gorilla suit that.
I know everybody's heard of Ruth's Chris Steakhouses.
Sure.
Well, Rodney Frotel was Ruth's husband, and Rodney was an eccentric millionaire, and he was fascinated with gorillas. In fact, he went to Singapore and bought the first two gorillas for Ottoman Zoo, the Ottoman Park Zoo. And he brought the gorillas over, and then a week later, he went and bought a little TV and put it in the cage up at the top because he didn't want the gorillas to be bored. So, and then he was a character, and he loved horse racing. And he would he wanted to run for mayor one year. So he got thousands of little gorillas, half of them white, half of them were black, and he would pass them out. Well, he wanted to advertise, The first Planet of the Apes movie with Charlton Heston and all of them. Well, he went to Hollywood and bought the main gorilla suit. And believe me, see, that gorilla suit, when he got my brother, he'd pay my brother $50 to wear the gorilla suit for him. And he put the gorilla suit on. And if you didn't know it was him, it looked like a real good, all the padding and all. And my brother kind of grunted pretty good. So we used to laugh. And he'd get him to go with him to different, like he went to Louis Roussel's bank, the American bank, and was advertising and handing out the gorillas. And Chris was in the gorilla suit. My brother and them, they had a whole lot of fun with that gorilla suit because they live on Marengo Street right off of Canal. And they would take the gorilla suit and they would go at midnight. They'd go out by the park and they'd have the bus stop and the people would be waiting at the bus stop and they'd start moving the bushes and everything and then the gorilla would jump out.
that scared people? Unbelievable.
And so they did this two or three times, and they got all of these people calling up, you know, the police. Man, the gorilla got loose from the zoo. The gorilla got loose from the zoo. And they go check it out. Finally, they realize what was going on. So they come banging on the door. One of the policemen knew Danny Caballero, my brother, and all of them. Come banging on the door. Open up, open up. And back in those days, some guys, you know, kind of did a little, you know, things that wouldn't open up. And they, well, everything's fine. We didn't know. No, open up. We got to talk to you. He said, no, we don't want to know what you got in there or anything. We got to talk to you about something else. So he says, I got the captain with me. If you don't open up, we're going to bust it down. So they open up the door. And he says, what's the matter? He says, all I want to tell you is that if we get one more gorilla sighting from the gorilla escaping from the zoo, y'all all going to jail. So that was the last of the gorilla suits.
It's unbelievable. It's so funny you bring him up because Saturday after the races, McGowey brought me to Crescent City Stakes.
Oh, that's...
And his man O'Keefe was chief counsel for Ruth. Right. And he told us the whole story about her original location.
Right down Broad,
When her first husband, I guess, died, and she was, or left, and she was alone with the kids, and how she bought this restaurant that she saw an ad in the paper, bought the restaurant, and it was called Chris's Steakhouse.
Right.
And then when she had a fire, then she moved on Broad Street.
On Broad Street.
And the original
Roof's Chris
because the Greek that was Chris said you can't use it's okay
my name
it was okay at the old location but this new location you can't use my name and so that's why it's Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and O'Keefe told us the whole fascinating story brilliant businesswoman with no training
no
nothing wasn't a restaurateur. It just was and then built it from there, made all kinds of, everybody that worked for her made a fortune.
Oh, Lana Duke was one of my sister's best friends. And Lana, my sister goes with Lana all the time to parties and stuff at her house and all. And Lana actually owns three Ruth's Chris's herself in San Antonio. And
she gave franchise rights to
and
all
Lana,
the people.
Lana has the tomb next to Ruth's that she's going to be buried next to Ruth when she goes.
And Ruth liked the races.
Oh, right. Actually, she was the first licensed woman trainer in the state of Louisiana.
Is that right?
Ruth Fertel, yeah. And their horse, Tudor Tambourine, is buried in the infield.
Really?
Yeah. He won a New Orleans handicap, and when he died, they buried him in the infield. He don't have a monument, but he's buried in the infield.
Doesn't have a marker?
No, doesn't have a marker. But he is buried in the infield.
There's a lot of that. I uncovered a story at Pimlico up in the press box. Very similar guy from Charlestown who never made it to the Maryland circuit, and his daughter brought his ashes and buried him in the infield at Pimlico.
And
there's no marker. There's no nothing. There's Shane Wilson's joined us too, we'll round out more conversation. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You had yourself some meat.
Yeah, it went well. You know, we knew coming in we were pretty loaded. You know, we had a lot of horses, a lot of conditions, you know, turf horses, maidens. We have a lot of cheaper horses that the big outfits don't have. So we had a lot of boxes checked when we started out, and it worked out well. We brought our own rider with us this year, and I think that was huge to have someone who's confident. You know, that's the only problem we have here with a lot of the other ones that come in. You know, we don't go to Kentucky and New York and, you know, everything. So, you know, they don't sell in 100% on what we tell them. But I brought my own rider in this year, and he's won over, I think, 125 races the last two summers for me between Louisiana Downs and Evangeline. So we get together at the barn in the morning and watch videos and get a game plan and go out there and try to figure out where the speed is, where the pace, where we want to be. And it worked out great. I couldn't be happier.
We've talked at least once during the meet because, you know, you got all the Britland, you know, the Britland. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, talk about some Cadillacs, essentially, in the ranks of the Louisiana breads and so the star guitars. It's a great situation.
Yeah, no, they're so talented, you know, and they can do anything. You know, you get I didn't really have a lot of star guitars before working for Miss Benoit. You know, I watched them through the years, but then to have them in the barn with them, I mean, they're you can train on them, you can do whatever you want to do. You can't get them out of the feed tub, you know, which is what we're hoping for as a trainer. You know, the fillies, you can train them hard, and they keep eating, keep responding well to everything. And, you know, once we got to kind of play with them a little bit and figure a few of them out, still have a few we haven't figured out yet. But for the most part, they've done well for us.
Well, I tell you what, one thing I've noticed over the whole course of this season is, and I guess you must look at the breeding or you look at the conformation of the horse, you've taken a lot of chances with dirt horses and trying them on the turf and had a lot of success this year.
Yeah, I guess a nerd. I like to study those pedigrees, you know, and a lot of the ones that we claim, you know, like the one yesterday in the maiden, that mile and eighth maiden special weight got beat ahead, you know, and his mother was all turf, You know, she's produced all turf horses, you know, so we throw him out there, and we almost got away with it. 29-1 got beat ahead. And, you know, that was some of the things with Evelyn's horses that were really shocking once I started studying their pedigrees. You know, when you look at Rue La La, her mother never ran on the dirt, stakes winner on the turf, route stakes winner. Rue La La's been a sprinter on the dirt her whole life. Overcharge's mother never won a dirt race, never won a sprint race. So she ran on the turf one time and went by 7 lengths. So it was always a goal to get her back on the turf. And, you know, so I like to study pedigrees. And really the one that is just a freak deal is Cali Coco.
In fact, that long shot ran third in the stake race yesterday. That's by the same sire. And I used them in the trifecta just because of that. I said, well, wait a minute, that other Cali Coco, the one that won 3 in a row, I said, this is the same sire. And all of a sudden, might they have a chance to throw in the gimmicks?
You know what? And the turn was a little soft yesterday. They were complaining. But if you notice in the turn, he had to really slow him down. He was sliding.
Right, yeah. No, I thought he was going to win for a minute the way he moved up. Yeah.
Yeah, Guerrero come back and he said, man, he was slipping in the turn. But once he got leveled out 6 wide in the middle of the track where it's firm, he come running again. But, yeah, with Cali Coco, he's a horse that stakes placed here last year in the slop. He run second to late September, and it ended up being like his best race he ever ran for. So during the summer, it's hard to get some races to go for him. And so I asked Ty and Trish Smith, I said, you know, I'd like to throw him on the grass just because he ran well in the slop. And they said, well, if you want to try it, we'll try it. We went to Evangeline and won easily, and then got hooked into a really fast pace at Louisiana Downs and ran a second. And then he gets here, and, you know, I'm so happy to have Jose Guerrero. You know, I told him, I said, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen here. If you'll ship him out of the gate, these good, smart riders are going to let you have it because the stretch is so long. Yeah. They're going to think they're going to run you down. And I said, when you get out there and get loose, you can dictate the race and
slow it down.
And it's happened 3 times.
Right, 3 times in a row. And I was amazed. His last race, I had him as the program favorite, and he ended up paying, what, $14, $15 or whatever. Yeah. I couldn't believe it because I said, well, mate, his figures are better than anybody in the race. I thought he would go off the favorite, and he didn't. But like you said, they, you know, they get the big riders come in, and they all jump on them and, you know, leave the locals alone.
And I think he's a Louisiana bred in an open race. You know, but that condition that Scott writes, that A other than, you know, which is essentially an open race for horses that have never won an allowance race, and I can run a Louisiana bred in there that's won 2 or 3 allowance races already. You know, and if I look at the numbers a lot, so if the numbers fit and it looks like we can compete, I'm not afraid running open. You know, we beat them horses, I think, 4 or 5 times this meet. Rue La La with, you know, Cali Coco, and that's why I was trying it again yesterday with Calabrosa Kid just to take a shot.
Right.
But he hooked a really, that was really nice, 2 horses that beat him.
Oh, yeah, Demolition Duke and Son of a Bird, those are real nice horses, yeah.
Yeah, Son of a Bird, so I've played him every time he's running this meet. So he's going to show up
he's
when
a
I run
runner.
Against him.
Yeah, no, he's a runner.
He beat me yesterday.
I like Cali Coco, and... well, I was with Frank on Thursday, with Frank McGowan, and we were talking about that. That's what made this card fun. I mean, the stakes are going to be the stakes, but the maiden races were good. The turf mile and the main 3/4, mm-hmm. and that allowance was a, and then to get $15 on him, fabulous.
That was amazing to me. You're right.
Yeah. He's something, too. You wouldn't believe how small he is. He might be 800 pounds.
Oh, jeez. He is a little guy.
On a big day. He's a little bitty horse, but he gets out there on the lead and gets a big heart. And you know, it's like Guerrero said. He said, we put him in such a position to where they know if they go with him, they may not finish the race. He says, so they either go put pressure on him and cost themselves the race, he said, or they sit back behind me and they got to follow him all the way around there. And, you know, luckily he's
and a lot of them front runners, when they get a free and easy lead, they get a big heart, and they just keep digging in when you try to come get them.
That's right. No pressure. You get out there and just cruise.
That's the best part. It's funny. If horses are looking each other in the eye, they're exerting some energy that they don't need. But when they're on by themselves, they relax and really just get in a rhythm.
Yeah.
The horse I talked about, the horse that was second, that Devil's Harvest, an Oregon bred, and Kent Knutson, who Frank tells me was Deodoro's assistant.
Yes.
And that horse at 24-1 ran a terrific race. The hold second, Caternion was coming on him. I missed the Oregon bred. I used Caternion, this was fun.
So we handicapped and thought that the nuts and horse would be the other speed. And so I told Jose, I said, if you can't stay in the 3 or 4 path, so if they decide to go with you, you can put them on the inside and you can pressure them between the rail and you can dictate how much pressure he gets. I said, but don't clear and go to the rail, because if he comes up, then he's going to be on your outside pressing you the entire race. I said, so stay in the middle of the track in the three or four path, and then that way if he comes in, you can make it tight or not on him, and he rode a perfect race.
Good instructions.
Hey, Shane Wilson with us and Mikey DiLiberto. And Shane, I don't remember. I'm sure we did, because you've been on a couple times with me. But you know, for you, background and your avenue into the game.
I started out at the track. I was 14 years old and wanted to get a vehicle when I turned 15. And my dad was in the military, and I was very blessed. I was adopted by him, and he was very strict, you know. So if I wanted a vehicle, I had to get a job, because he wasn't going to pay for it. And so I was working at McDonald's in Halton, right on top of the hill from Louisiana Downs. And I was making $75 a week, and I had a guy come in one morning getting a cup of coffee early, and I asked him if he was fishing or hunting or what he was doing, and he said he was going to the racetrack. And it ended up being Larry Robidoux, actually.
Right.
And I said, has they got anything that I could do down there to make money? And he said, you could just walk horses around the barn for 30 minutes after they train and make $125, $130 a week. Well, I was making $75 a week at McDonald's. So the next morning, I was sitting on the rail at the racetrack at the fence, and Jack Vanberg needed a hot walker. And Diane Alexander and David Jelpy were the assistants there, and I went to work for them and knew nothing about it. Never had touched a horse ever.
Wow.
And so the first one they handed to me, I'll never forget, is a black stud horse named Frightener. And I made one lap around the barn, and he bit me in the chest and my ribs. And one of the older grooms grabs him and says, man, somebody's got to get this greenhorn before they kill him. And so they actually took that one from me, and they give me a mare the next time. And I'm 15 years old, and her name was High Kid. And she was a champion Louisiana bred, that your older mare, and she was a sweetheart. As I was daydreaming walking around the barn, she would just stop me at her water bucket to get a drink of water and remind me. And
I said, this is her. Doing something.
She gets a drink of water. And so I started doing that every summer. I'd get out of school and work for Jack Vanberg until football practice would start in high school, and just progressed through that, you know, end up being they let me start grooming the pony. And you know, I worked for Jack those, I think it was 3-4 summers out there, and it was great. You know, to tell you the thing that's really surprising is to see the things that we do now as Jack Vanberg was doing it in 1984.
Believe me, Jack Vanberg, now you talk about you, but you're talking about Frankie Brothers, Billy Mott, Jelfie, even Danny Dano, a lot of top trainers. All learned originally from Jack Vanberg.
You know, at that age, I didn't have any idea. But looking back at it now, he would fly into town. They'd jog every horse in the barn on the street. And he'd have Diane Alexander there with a clipboard. And he'd tell him, need to inject this one ankle. Need to work on this one's back. Need to start sweating this one's shoulders. He'd fly into town, fly out. And I remember one Thursday, we won 5 races on the card after he had left. You know, and now as soon as you get a horse that has any kind of issue, what does the vet do? They take him outside and jog him on the street and look at him. And he was doing that back then. I mean, he had a vibrating plate at the end of the barn. We had to hold horses on it with sore feet in the barn. You know, I mean, he was having to sit hosing horses. He's get on me. I'd be sitting on a bucket on the wash rag hosing a horse's shin, falling asleep as a kid, you know, and he'd walk by and tap me on the shoulder and he'd say, try to get a little bit of water on her legs if you can while you're here, you know. scare me to death, you know, like, yes, sir.
Hey, you know what? Like you're talking about, he was ahead of the game, actually, in those days. And think about it. They did this in the racing form. I don't know if you remember it, but Jack Vanberg had, like they do now, Asmussen and Cox and Pletcher and all, have horses at several different racetracks. Well, he was winning so many races, they put in the rule that you had to be physically on the track at least every 7 days or you don't get credit for the wins. So that's why he don't have as many wins as he could have had, because
wow,
they put that rule in. And then, you know, 20 years ago, they dropped it and went back to, you know, you can do whatever. Because back in those days, they didn't have them flights and every way you could pop them back and forth the tracks. Now you can get there easily, you know, where they do it.
Yeah, it was great. You know, we started there, and I'll tell you a funny Jack story. When they used to have the Super Derby Festival, so he brought in a filly from California. I can't remember her name now. I was 18, 19. I was grooming the horse, so excited to be in the stakes race, and she's the favorite, and Larry Snyder's riding the horse. So we bring it up there, and the horse was fourth around the backside, opens up, turning for home, stays fourth, and just finished fourth. Got beat a couple of lengths. And I can see Jackie's walking down. His face is red, and he's got his white, you know, shirt on. And he walks out there, and, man, he just jumps all over Larry Snyder and asks him, what in the world are you doing? He said, I could have drove my Mercedes through the rail there. He said, you just keep sitting and sitting. Well, Larry, he just takes his saddle off and hands it to his valet, and he turns around and puts his hand on Jack's shoulder, and he said, Jack, have you ever seen a hole outrun your horse?
He said, the hole was moving faster than the horse.
He said, I'd have been in that hole if I could catch it. He said, but the hole outrun your horse. Jack couldn't say a word. He just turned around and walked off. And I thought that was a classic. But yeah, we did that every summer. And then I went to Louisiana Tech, tried to play football for a couple years, and didn't work. You know, got hurt like everybody else. And came back home and tried to go to school and work, and just didn't have interest in school once I wasn't playing football. That was a reason to go to class. And, you know, I got to missing so many classes. I had a professor tell me if I didn't come the next day, just don't come anymore. And I figured that's probably good advice. I was wasting money. So I went back to the track and got a job, and, shoot, been there ever since. You know.
And you got your son Connor. Connor was sharp as a man. Believe me, for a young kid, he's sharp as a tack. He knows a lot about a lot of things with horse racing.
Connor loves it. I tell you, actually, he's just a brilliant kid. Me and Becky, my wife, we've been so blessed. You know, we have two sons. My oldest son is actually fixing to graduate with his master's degree in mechanical engineering at LSU right now. He graduated 4.18 GPA, and then Connor falls in. And my oldest, Peyton, he'll tell you that Connor's the smart one out of the group. And he got a mind like a sponge for this stuff.
Believe me, when we talk to him, he's pretty sharp with what he knows. He knows a lot about a lot of things around the racetrack.
And other tracks. You know, he'll come walking up to me and he's like, man, Dad, did you see the third at Santa Anita? And I'm like, son, I got a lot of stuff on my mind.
You got a lot of horses that you take care of.
I got clients.
You ain't got time to look at all them other races.
And, you know, he'll tell you, well, that's the one we watched it run second at Keeneland last year, opening day, you remember? He said, you just won at Santa Anita. I'm like, man, son. And he does college at night after we get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. We're at the barn by 4. A lot of times we run home for 20 minutes, change clothes, to come back with his 12:30 post, and then we don't get finished till 6, 7 at night. Well, he comes home, takes a shower, gets on the computer, and he does school for LSU.
Wow.
Mom said the only way he's not going to college, actually be there physically, is if he's going to be taking it online. So he's studying finance online, and he's 4.0. He hasn't.
No, that's great. That's great. And believe me, your whole family is just a bunch of really nice, down-to-earth people. And I think, you know, I find that the whole state of Louisiana is kind of like that. You know, it's just people love to come visit down here because everybody welcomes with open arms.
Yeah, I'd say it's just great to get to do what we do. You know, I mean, it's a lot of hours, you know, but I have friends that ask me, you know, they say, man, why in the world do you want to work 7 days a week? And, you know, I tell them all the same thing. I said, you know, you guys that have those jobs that suck, y'all get weekends and holidays. But if you have something that you love doing, don't need a weekend or holiday. You know, I mean, we're out there this morning jogging horses, going over them, you know, and meet's over with, but we got to change gears now and start focusing on Evangeline and getting horses ready for that. And, you know, it's a blessing to have your family involved. You know, my wife's been at Louisiana Downs all winter. She actually just came down yesterday, the first day she's been here for the meet, because we have 50 horses at Louisiana Downs, and she has two employees that help her oversee everything. And so she, you know, I think the last 4 wins we had here, 3 came from Louisiana Downs, so you shipped them down. And so I told her she needed to be here for the trophy presentation, and she said, well, that's you and Connor's deal. Y'all, yeah, I said, hey, me and Connor's deal. Y'all are sending winners down here.
Absolutely.
You know, she tells me, we'll just ship them to you, and you and Connor try not to mess it up. And it's worked out good.
Did you meet her on the track?
That's why he stays married so long. He makes sure she's included in a lot of things.
Hey, you know what? I was actually working for Sam David in the barn that I'm in at Louisiana Downs right now in B9. And my wife's father, Jim O'Brien, he trained horses.
I remember that name.
And she was running the barn for her dad. And, you know, it's so crazy. I wear khaki pants and glasses. And, you know, she wears Wranglers and cowboy boots and drives a pickup truck. Nothing like anything I've ever went out with. And she would walk through the end of the barn every morning to go to the restroom in the steaks barn. And I would try to speak to her. You know, I'd tell her, good morning, how are you? And she'd just walk right by. I said, it made it where it's a mission. She's going to speak to me, you know. So I go down there every morning, and it's like, good morning, how you doing? She just walked right on by. I said, man, it's this thing. You know, so one day I had a horse. Sam let me have a horse of my own while I was running Sam's barn, and I was out grazing my horse. She come walking out one afternoon while I was grazing. She said, this must be your horse, huh? You graze it every afternoon. And I said, dang, you can speak?
I thought you were a mute.
I thought maybe you were a mute or something, you know. And, well, come to find out, her dad didn't want her messing with anybody on the racetrack. And so once dad was gone, she could come talk to me. And, man, you know what? About 3 afternoons after that, we're out grazing. I was grazing my horse, and we talked. And she said, when you get finished with your horse, just go grab a bite somewhere. And, you know, we went to dinner that night and have never been apart. Dated a year, been married 26 years now. And first date and never looked back.
Yeah, you know? Good thing Sam gave you that horse, huh?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's why she never would have talked to me.
Never would have spoken to me. That's right.
Yeah, one of the blacksmiths had told me, they said, she'd ask, who is this guy? He was like a nerd with those glasses on, those khaki pants every day. And I guess the nerd stuck on her, I guess.
So great.
Let me ask you this. I heard you talking to Christofek yesterday. There's a possibility that Overcharge might show up in Kentucky?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the plan. You know, she jogged super this
morning.
Well,
she sure looks like that. Like she's the surface, the turf is just unbelievable. I mean, she's a runner on any surface, but on the turf, it looks like she has a second, a second gear that she takes off.
Oh, I know, you know, and after watching her first win when she won on the turf, and it was actually her largest margin of victory, she'd won by 7.5 lengths, and so I wanted to get her back.
And she beat a very good filly in Overite. I mean, that's a multiple graded stakes winner that she beat.
Yeah, you know what made me do that? We ran on the dirt. The stakes before that, we won, and Overay was in 2 races earlier than us. So she ran on the same surface, same day, everything. She runs like an 84, we run a 96. And I said, man, I'm gonna try her in this open race because I think she should excel on the turf the way her mother does. I think the mares have so much to do with what they turn out doing. And whenever she turned around and beat Overay like she did, and there was a couple of other good mares.
Oh, no, yeah, we find it.
Mott had a great stake.
Yeah, the money shipped in the club, yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't no easy race.
And so she left a little feed last night because she ran hard, you know, regardless, but she jogged sound this morning. She was perfect, had her tail up in the air on the concrete this morning and bright-eyed and eating peppermints. So we're gonna push for the May the 4th Oaks Day, you know, unless Miss Benoit has another plan. That's what our plan is for her. And
I know Evelyn likes to go to the Derby, so that would make sense that she'd want to go up there, because for years, Evelyn, Edna Carden, Lula Dada, and Miss Joanne Stewart, that was the four ladies, and they'd get decked out with the hats and everything, and they'd always be sitting up and they were in the front part, and Brian and Joe Sherman, all of us, were in the next room right over, and they were all at the Derby every year, all of them.
Well, supposedly her sister is going to run up there, you know, the one that's been in Saudi Arabia, that Manamor Gold.
Right, I've seen that.
Manama Gold, yeah.
That one, yeah, won a stake or something over in Dubai or whatever.
Actually broke her maiden in a stake in December and come back and has won 2 stakes since, and supposedly they're going to move her over to Todd Pletcher for the Oaks. So if so, we could have two Charged Cotton fillies running on Oaks Day Louisiana breds at Churchill.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, like you were talking about Star Guitar. It's amazing that his horses handled turf and dirt. I mean, they run on anything.
And he never stepped foot on the
turf. Never stepped foot on the turf, right.
And I guess maybe Al Stahl must have thought he would like it, because Miss Benoit said that she had asked him a couple of times, and he wondered if you put him on the turf, he may not ever run on the dirt good again. So, you know, he saw something there. But, yeah, the quiet American, you know, and then he has the what you call it, Majestic Light on the bottom side.
Right.
I mean,
that
everything
was
about it should be turf.
Turf,
you know,
yeah,
that's
that was
I
turf.
I keep throwing them out there, you know, putting them on the turf. And, I mean, like Behemoth yesterday, you know, he can.
I was just looking at.
That race fell apart, you know, when everybody scratched, you know, and it ended up. The only thing I was afraid of, and he kind of did it, I warned Jose to not slow him down and make him as slow as they are.
And they went kind of slow, real slow.
First quarter, he's got him.
Yeah.
You know, that's the big thing with me with speed. I played sports and everything, and I believe if you have speed, you have an advantage.
They got to come where you already been.
Yeah, so don't slow your horse down to where you're as slow as they are. You're taking your advantage from it.
Right.
You know, and when he put up that 26th quarter, I said to myself, if he gets beat here today, he's going to get it when he comes back. Because I told him we went 23-47, 112, and he's been right there. And then when we ran the day against Jackhammer, Jose was worried there was too much speed with Cali Coco in there and him. And, you know, I told him, I said, it doesn't matter. You have to let him run his race.
His race, yeah.
And then we break and take back, and they go 23-47, 112. And then we're chasing him, and we end up running second. So I wanted to make sure we didn't do that yesterday, because he has those gears. He can be up there. And I think he's a better horse when he's up in the race. I think he gets more excited.
It seems like that's his biggest race is when he's right up there on the pace.
Exactly.
And yesterday, when Bruno Talkin was head and head, I'm like, wait a minute, he's a big closer. What's he doing? And then I looked at the corner. I went, LaWanda, he's up there. That's where he usually is.
You can't. It's always a mistake. And one of the things that you can see it when you watch a horse that's just out there rolling, and especially as they come to the end of the backstretch, and all of a sudden guys are asking, and you know, the speed horse, you know, relaxed on the lead, isn't being asked, and everybody else is now panicking to try to catch up. You're forcing them out of their game.
Yeah.
And Luis Saez, spectacular at it, and then especially heading into the turn, and all of a sudden leans forward and accelerates, yeah. And now everybody's panicked. And you know they have trouble getting wind. They you know, the horse panics because the jocks panic, and you just cruise away.
And it's over with. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Everybody, you know, I hear it all the time. Well, your rider, he likes to be in front, but it's not so much the rider. The trainer likes to be in front. I mean, I think if I can get there, you're gonna have to work harder to come get me.
Exactly.
You know? And so I think breaking the gate's essential. You have to get out of the gate.
Well, all these quarter horse guys, Lucas, Baffert, Asmussen to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
It's all speed.
It's all speed. It's a very
common
simple
denominator
concept. It's you know, look, and I don't know if you've ever heard it down here, but the great, you know, the Jerkins quote about. And I don't know if it was Mig that did it, but I Mig will tell me who it was. Jock comes back after trying to rate one on the lead, and the chief says, "You know what are you doing out there?" He says, "Well, I wanted to save something." He said, "Horses have been running away from things. I got a jock for 6,000 years. He says, I got a jock trying to change evolution."
That's exactly right. I feel the same way. I tell them all the time. I said, if you watch human athletes, watch a track star. If he can jump out, no, he don't slow down and wait for everybody
else
to
try
to outkick him.
He got a good chance of winning.
Yeah, when you have that speed, you have an advantage, you know. And like I said, they have to have another gear to come get you, you know. I like to be cruising on the lead going long, especially.
No, exactly. That it's one.
Oh, because you can dictate the pace. You,
exactly.
You know, and believe me, you see the ones that go by, they always seem to give them a breather going around the turn. Before they get into some sort of stretch, because they and the other riders still sitting, they're not realizing. Well, wait, we went 25 this quarter, not 24, and they're just sitting. So you got something left when you come into the stretch.
And I think that especially holds here with this long stretch. I think a lot of the riders have it in their mind that they can let you get away because they have this stretch to go. And that's why I tried to get Jose to come last year to come ride for me. He didn't want to this year. I told him, I said, I'm gonna have 100 horses and you can ride them all. I said, you're never going to have more support than you're going to get if you'll come here. And I said, this track is going to fit you to a T because you're a great gate rider. I said, when you break open up two, they're going to take back because they think, oh, we can get them in this long stretch. I said, but if you're going 6 furlongs, you're going 6 furlongs. If the stretch is 3 furlongs or 1 furlong, you're still running 6 furlongs. So if you can get away the first 3/8 easy, it's still 6 furlongs regardless of the length of the stretch.
And then contrary to what a lot of people think, because of the long stretch, this track actually favors speed.
Absolutely.
Actually does. You don't maybe 5 times out of the whole meet you'll see where closers have a big advantage. Most of the time it's the speed, especially early races, that the speed's real dangerous.
Yeah, I think it's the mindset. I think a lot of them, you know, the rider, man, you've got to watch this stretch. You know, now I like to get in here early. We get in here and try to start breezing horses, and I have Jose come over, and we'll have horses been running all summer, working them 3/8, because I want him to get a feel for this stretch, this finish, you know, because a lot of horses, when you get here, first few workouts you have, they'll pass the eighth pole and go back to the left lead because they're not used to running this far.
Yeah,
down
further.
Yeah, and then the more they get to do it, the more they get to saving themselves for it. You know, I think the horses have to learn to negotiate this stretch.
Oh, it is
well
long stretch, yeah, because all the other tracks are going to get the shorter stretch. Yeah, that's true.
1,308 feet.
That's what it is?
Yeah. Churchill's 1,234.
We actually have the longest stretch yet. Just for a couple of years, Sportsman, when they configured it different, had it beat us, but then Sportsman closed down, and that was it. That's a, you know, I'll tell you that funny story. Gene Cilio was a trainer here for many years, mm-hmm. good friend of mine, and he's leading trainees. Well, he's died for the leading trainer up at Sportsman. So he calls me and Kerry Dubuque. She was the head clocker for a bunch of years, and we're really good friends with Gene. So Gene says, look, I need you and Kerry. I want y'all to come up. I'm going to win the training title. I got 5 horses in the last day. 3 of them are the favorites. The only guy I'm tied with's got 1, and he's 20-1. He says, if I don't win, I'm still tied. So if I win, I'll be by myself. I'm going to have a big party and everything and all. So Kerry says, come on, let's go. So we fly up to Chicago. Gene comes, picks us up at the airport. We drive into the track. It's the last day to meet at Sportsman. We're pulling in the parking lot, and some guy's waving Gene down. Gene's got his own private parking spot. He's real good friends with the Bidwells and them. So he's waving, so he stops. He says, what's the matter? Oh, Mr. Gene, you ain't going to believe it. He said, they canceled the races. He goes, what do you mean they canceled? It's a gorgeous day. What are you talking about? He says, well, you know they're having that big concert after the races in the infield? He says, yeah. He said, well, they built that big stage at the AFPO, and it's too close to the rail, and horses were shying from it. So they told him they're going to have to take that stage down. Well, they told him if we take the stage down, we can't get it back up for the concert, so cancel the concert. And the Bidwell said, well, cancel the races, then we want the concert. Wow. So the last day of the meet at Sportsman was never run. The last day. So Gene, well, Hawthorne opened the next day across the street, so we went to the races at Hawthorne the next day.
Wow.
And that day, Gene says, well, you know what? You ever been to Arlington? I said, nah, I ain't been to Arlington. He says, come on, we're going. I said, well, it's not open. He says, come on, we're going all out. I'm going to give you all a tour. We go drive up, and Duchess White was best friends with Duchess White. Drive up, talks to the guard, and all of a sudden he comes out with a sack full of 20 keys on it. He says, come on, we're going in. I got keys to everything. We're going to go. And there wasn't nobody in the place. The place was empty. You're going to give us the whole tour, the whole racetrack.
Wow.
The Bidwells owned Sportsman's?
Yeah, we all, and then ended up selling it or whatever. But it ended up being a race. They wanted to make it
an auto track, yeah.
Which never really turned out very good, I don't think.
No, they had those couple of oddball years. You know, the Illinois Derby was there, and then they converted over. It was a mess.
That's when War Emblem won the
exactly,
Illinois Derby. There, and
exactly.
Baffert bought him, and he went over.
Frank Springer. And
Springer had him here at the fairgrounds, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you
a funny Frank Springer story. You notice after January 1st, 2-year-olds aren't allowed on the racetrack here. And that's basically an insurance thing. You get a much bigger insurance cut if you don't have 2-year-olds on the racetrack after the first of the year. So we get to be in March, and Mervyn would always tell us, you know, make sure, you know, there ain't no 2-year-olds working. We don't want them on the tab. Even if they sneak in, you know, we don't give them no work. Well, Pettingill, he was at the end of the meet, and he was kind of lackadaisical. So Springer works a horse out the gate, works 47-1, visiting around the thing. So Billy puts it in, and he don't check, and it's a 2-year-old. And 2 weeks later, he's in the entries at Keeneland, and Mervyn sees the races for him, and he sees the fairgrounds work. What? And he whistled, win by 5. He called Billy up. I can't believe you. That ever happens again, you're fired.
I loved Mervyn, boy. He was great.
Oh, he was. Yeah, Mervyn was the greatest. Yeah, I'm laughing. You know, look at me. I had lost somebody, but during the summer we used to be in and. It didn't have a lot to do. We do media guides and stuff. But main thing on the course during the summer was where Mervyn wanted to go to lunch. And he wanted to go at 11 o'clock. So we'd go to lunch. And Miss Joanne Stewart was here forever. She was the secretary for 4 different owners of the racetrack. And she knew me since I'm a grand because I went to school with her older son. And she comes walking. I'm walking down the hall one day, and she looks. She goes, I said, what's the matter? She says, you ought to sue him. I said, sue who? She says, Mervyn and Captain Maestri. I said, what am I going to sue him for? She said, disfigurement. They keep bringing you to them big lunches every day. I said, okay, I understand.
Yeah. Well, how does anybody stay remotely in shape around here?
Got a lot of good food in this state. Whole state's got a lot of good food everywhere you go.
And you got to stay busy.
You had a little thing last night, right? After the races.
Yeah, we cooked some crawfish and just whoever wanted to come by and had some, and it was good. I was out there at 8:30, back in bed at 9. Man, I mean, it was great.
Get up early.
Time to go to bed. We ran 13 horses yesterday.
I was
going to
say, you were in all day long yesterday.
Yeah, we wanted to go out with a bang. You know, the races got canceled a week before,
right?
And it brought a bunch of those back, and But yeah, I kept telling Guerrero, I said, if you just keep it close to the last day, I'm gonna get you there the last day. I said, you just stay close.
I told a couple of people, he said, who's gonna be the leading rider? I said, well, if he's only one or two behind going in the last day, he looks really tough.
Exactly. Yeah, I wanted him to get it. I was so proud of him to have the the nerve.
Oh no!
You know,
to make that move.
His wife and his child live in Vinton, and he could just go there and ride at Delta. And I told him, I said, you know, for you to get to be a better rider, you need to ride with better riders. I said, you can stay over there and ride $4,000 horses for the rest of your career. I said, you know, if this doesn't work, you can always go back and do that. And for him to just jump ship, left his business that he had over there, and left his wife and his son, and come over here and have faith in us. You know, I was really wanting him to get it the last day.
Y'all had a good partnership. I know that because y'all did good together.
What does he do now, though? I mean, and that's actually a good follow-up question, too, because I mentioned at the beginning of the show when I just was talking about what a great culture there is here. And, you know, to have a circuit of four racetracks, it just doesn't exist anywhere else anymore in the country. There's some regions, you know, there's some regional, you know, and obviously New York's year-round with the three tracks, but and ultimately it'll be two. But nobody's got what you guys have here with Evangeline, Delta, and Louisiana Downs.
Yeah, it makes it great. Like you said, the owners get a chance, you know, and that's what the whole thing is, the owners. You know, you get a chance to have opportunity for them to pick up checks. You know, we don't have near the money in the summertime that we have, but we have two tracks. Don't really overlap each other, maybe one day a week. So we should have 6 days of racing that we can go. And, we're going to have a stable at Evangeline this year with Connor, and I'll be at Louisiana Downs. And we got a handful of horses we're going to take to Churchill that, you know, we think can fit. We don't have a stable to bring or anything like that, but we have a few of these open horses we're going to ship up and take a shot, try to run at them big purses. But for the most part, we'll stay here. And, you know, that's what I told Jose last night when he was hugging me and thanking me for everything. You know, I said, you know, this something to think about. You know, you're leading rider at the fairgrounds. If you ever wanted to try to move up the country and take a chance, and he said he's going wherever I go.
So, so smart. You got yourself a third son.
Yeah, so,
you got three sons now.
I guess we'll be at Louisiana Downs, getting the babies ready for this place. We'll try to do the same thing. We'll freshen some up, and then I want to come in here next year and, you know, try to be the same way. Fresh horses, lots of conditions, Louisiana breds, and see if we can't do it two times in a row.
How many other clients beside Britland?
Oh, shoot. Well, we have Mr. Davis, of course. We've been together 16 years now.
I've got a lot of horses with him and do well.
Yeah, he keeps about 20, 22 with me for the last 16 years. Yeah, he's 94 years old. He'll be 95 in June.
Wow.
And he finished second in the owner standings here, you know, so he's aggressive, though. He wanted to win it. And I dropped a couple in this week from 30 to 5 to give him a chance, and he called me and told me, scratch them horses. I said, well, I'm trying to get you home, because I knew Miss Evelyn had a big last day ahead of her, and he said, Shane, I'm not giving away horses to be the leading owner. It doesn't mean that much to me.
Good for him.
He made me scratch it up, but, I've been with him a long time. I actually have a guy, Joe Hackler. I keep a couple with him. We've been together since 98. Me and Kevin Fontenot, 12 years. Me and David Fontenot, he's another client. He actually... When I got out of this for 2 years and took a sales job to try to get my wife a normal life with weekends and holidays, and I just couldn't do it. And but me and David got back together. He actually, before I had any stalls, Jason Boulay was at Evangeline Downs, and I claimed a couple horses in with other trainers' names that I was not supposed to, but we did at Delta Downs when I actually didn't even have stalls yet. Jason gave me stalls before I had horses at Evangeline, and me and David got together when my oldest son was in kindergarten, and he's out of college now, so that's been 16, 17 years. Jim Reeves, 12 years, 13 years, something like that. Of course, Mr. Davis, Evelyn. I got picked up Scott Roban this year. He had a good meet here. Won one yesterday and had a second with Funny Flame. And so we have a bunch of them. My wife could tell you exactly. She does the billing, but I know she stays on me all the time about another horse. What's the limit? When are we going to stop? And I told her, I keep telling her, I said, you remember whenever we was living in that travel trailer behind Don's Meat Market in Karen Crow, and you're sitting on the computer crying because we couldn't pay the stall rent or the feed bill? I said, we're not going to quit until they quit sending them to us.
You're right. So,
it's going to come to that point, you know, just like for everybody. But, you know, as soon as they, if they want to send them, we're going to make room for them right now. You never know.
And it's got to be encouraging, obviously. And at the same time, you know, you watch you know, other parts of the country and here even, where it's not, you know, it's hard for outfits, for some outfits. Yes.
Oh, well, you know what it is? I think the biggest thing is you got to have the owners. And if you got a good rapport with your owners, they'll keep giving you good horses. Because, like, we got a bunch of trainers. Bobby Burnett's one that I'm good friends with. Bobby. Bobby's a good trainer, good horseman. But he don't have the owners, so he can't win. If you don't have the horse, I don't care how good of a trainer you are, you're not going to win races. Your job is to get them fit and ready and put them in the right spots. But if they're not capable, then so, and that just goes to show you, these days, and I know Amos and a bunch of them and Aspen, they half of their job is training the owners. And you probably got a little of that in you, too.
It is. And, you know, I tell a lot of the young guys that ask me, they're like, man, I say, you know what, the owner has to come first. And you know, and you can ask my wife, too. She'll tell me, put the phone down. Just, like, give it a break, you know. And, you know, Tom Holyfield and a bunch of these guys I'm with, you know, he's like, you know, when you run a horse, they want a phone call.
Oh, no, they want to be hands-on and want to know something almost every day about the horse.
Exactly. You know, and that's my thing. If you call me during the day, it may not be right then. You know, I may be on the phone, may have to call you later, maybe doing something. But before I go to bed at night, I talk to anybody that's called me throughout the day because, you know, you have to give them the attention. You know, that's what I tell Becky. If you don't want to call them, the guy in the barn next door to you, he'll call them.
Exactly.
Talk to them. And you know, and I think you have to be the honesty thing. You know, like I said, I have so many of these guys that have been with me whenever we were so excited to win one race a month, and they stayed with me, you know, because they knew that we were doing the best we could take care of the animal. We're doing everything we can do. And a lot of the success that we're having now, aside of having Connor there with me now, he takes away a lot of the stuff. I can focus on what I need to focus on, where I used to have to cover
everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Connor takes a lot of that, you know, working with the vets, the blacksmiths. I mean, our help, he speaks Spanish like he is Spanish.
And you need, that's ideal to have that in your barn.
They come in my office and start talking to me. I tell them, go find Connor. I don't know how to speak Spanish. And so, I mean, Connor, he handles all that kind of stuff for me. But a lot of it, too, is that I've been blessed with the guys that I've been with all these years wanting to improve their stock. You know, I have some of these guys that always had a $5,000 horse, well, they've stepped up and claimed them one for 20. You know, they bought babies, you know, and the Kevin Fontenot buys yearlings every year for us. Scott Roban buys yearlings, and, you know, and that's a lot of it, you know, but you have to take care of those people.
And you got to think about it. It costs the same to feed a $5,000 horse as an allowance horse.
And, you know, one thing that I've tried to do through the years, and I still do it to this day, and Mr. Davis gets on me about it, is I try to spend their money like it's my money. You know, and you call me up and say, let's claim this horse. Well, I look at the replays on it so I can see his markings. And once I watch the replays of him and see his face, his legs, well, I go on the rail the next morning. We enter a week out. So I know that saddle tally is going to be in. And I wait till I see that horse. And when I watch him train 4 or 5 days, decide if I like the way he goes, then we decide if we're going to claim him or not. And, you know, you can't just, if somebody wants to spend $5,000, just go today and pick one out for $5,000 because
that's a crapshoot.
It's his money. Yeah. And, you know, and at the end of the day, I feel like I'm the one that's going to have to be expected to produce with it. So
you want to know what you're getting.
Exactly. And
well, that's Tom Amos, all them years he was doing so good with claiming horses when Frank Bernice was his assistant. Mm-hmm. Frank would be in the paddock every day. Marking horses.
Sure. That's exactly right. Well, see, I don't have the time to do that, so I do it with the replays. I have unlimited replays on Equibase, so I'll watch their last win to see them come into the paddock, I mean, the winner's circle, where I can see their face and legs and their markers, and then I'm on the rail the next day. I'll stay out there till the track closes looking for them, and I'll tell them, I said, man, I can never find the horse, and I don't want to just waste your money to do it, you know, and I've been lucky doing it that way. We hadn't got stuck too many times, but I think that's one thing that, you know, you have to spend their money like it's your money. You know, don't just do vet work to do vet work.
They appreciate that, too.
Exactly. I think that's why we have so many people that stay with us for so long. And, you know, we'll make bad claims, but you just have to let them know it's a bad one and try to get rid of it as soon as you can.
It's almost like a marriage. You know, you got to take care of each other.
Yeah, that's what Mr. Davis said. He said, much as you want to think you work for me, we're in a partnership. He said, because if I don't make money, you don't make money.
That's right.
And, you know, I think that's what... You know, we have really good clients that's been with us, but have become friends, and, you know.
A lot of people don't realize it, but like what you just said, trainers make money by winning races. They don't make much on the day rate.
No.
Because things are so expensive now, so you have to win races if you want to make money.
Well, my wife can tell you to the cent how much we spend on shavings this month, how much the payroll is. And, you know, your employees cost you more than you've ever had, and they're not as good as they used to be, but you still have to have them. And feed is up so high now. You know, you're paying almost $30 a bag for feed and, you know, alfalfa and hay. And, you know, it costs a lot. You're exactly right. You know, if you're not I tell everybody, I live on 1, 2, 3. You know, our 10%, first, second, third is where we make money.
That's it.
And the day money, you're making $3 a day a horse.
Yeah, right.
If you do it right, you know. Yeah. The guys that are making money on their day run, day money, aren't taking care of it.
Right, they're cutting corners.
Exactly. Yeah.
What we've gone this distance without bringing up some of the industry challenges that we're dealing with and external pressures. And one of the things we talk about, based on so far the experience involving ISA, a lot of observers and participants almost feel like the horsemanship is being taken out of the horseman's hands. You've got observers trying to essentially, legislate, and maybe you're not dealing with it down here as much as some other jurisdictions. But the situation with the regulatory vets and people that are making judgments and scratching horses and telling, essentially making those decisions. I suppose being down here under this circumstance, you're way better off.
Yeah, it's not near as bad here as it is everywhere. We still have rules. I think a lot of people that make the rules have never worked with horses. They've never been back there. They're getting advice. Everybody's a cheater. Nobody cares about the animals, which is the biggest joke. Huh. I mean, we spend 7 days a week with these things, and I
tell people, ask me about that, and I said, let me tell you one thing about it. I've been in a lot of people's barns back there. Those horses are treated better than their own kids.
I agree with that. I tell people all the time, they're treated better than your pet you have at home. You bathe your pet every day. You walk your pet every day. We get wormed every month. They get new shoes every 30 days. I like anybody that thinks the horses are mistreated to come to Shane Wilson's barn at any time. And you want to see how mistreated they are.
Right.
I mean, we love them.
That's what
we do. I got out of this. Like I said, I got out of this, took a sales job, made $135,000 in a year being a salesman. Quit that to go back to the racetrack because,
it's something that you got a passion for. You love it.
Yeah, we love them. I mean, there's no way. We're not going to lead a horse up that's not 100%. And, surely not going to ever do anything to harm one of them. It happens. You have injuries. They're just like athletes on ESPN. They get baseball players get hurt, football players. These horses get hurt, but they it's not because of the lack of what the people that are taking care of them do. You have a few handful of people that are going to win no matter what, and whatever limit they have to go do whatever they're going to do. But that's a very, very small portion of the people that do this for a living.
No, exactly. And I'm laughing. You're talking about family. Connor yesterday when he was talking about claiming right and just, and he says, he's like my little brother. I go everywhere with him. I'm in the stall with him. I'm in the van with him. I go everywhere with him.
Yeah, he keeps me from having that one in a spot that he could win because he don't want to lose him for anything. So every time I put him in a spot, he wins. I go to put him back. You're going to lose him. Can't lose him. I'm like, son, he's got to win. But that's what it's the way it is. We claimed him here for 50 as a 2-year-old, and he won an allowance race, and we got to go into the Risen Star and the Louisiana Derby with him. He's a bleeder, so that's another one of these dumb rules that they've put forth. Stakes horses stakes horses aren't bleeders, I guess.
Exactly.
Limited his what we could do with him. Actually, he bled in the Louisiana Derby, was third turning for home, and flattened, and we ended up going to the Lone Star Derby in Texas because you can use Lasix.
Right.
He run third, beating a length and a half over there, and he wins up Vangel Mile and John Henry Stakes. But we had to pick out stakes races he could run in where he could have Lasix.
Right.
Which is just a joke. I can't believe that they do that. You look at how many horses that bleed, and that's another, just like that. You're not comparing apples to apples.
No.
We get the closer you get to the ocean, like down here, you get the humidity, you get the barometric pressure. Horses can't run here without Lasix, but you go to New York, Canada, where you don't have the humidity and the air is thinner, and maybe they can, But people don't, these rules that they make, they don't look into stuff like that.
I talked to a vet and asked him about Lasix, and he told me, hey, every horse that runs bleeds to a degree. Because you as a person, if you exercise and run and do a lot, you're going to have a little light. But it might not show up. You ain't going to bleed out your nose or anything. On a scale of 1 to 10, it'd be a 1 or a 2. Maybe even a 3, but that don't really affect you. But if you're off of Lasix and you have it, you might be a 7 or 8, and then that's when it comes out. And really, so the Lasix is just really helping them from, you know, bleeding, and it's not really enhancing their ability to run faster.
No, I think it's a terrible rule. You know, I mean, I think if, you know, if it goes so far as, you know, so if you run and they run poor and you scope them and they bleed, document it, and then next time he can run on Lasix.
Well, that's where the way it was in New York for, you know, when Lasix was introduced, you had to prove it. Essentially, you had to come forward with, you know, with a
vet, yeah, scoped him and everything, and says, yeah.
But
so many of the rules, you know, like I said, it's just it's not horse friendly, you know, and you know, like with all the HISA and all the rules and everything. You know, to me, if they wanna do something, then improve the testing. You know, let's do more testing. I say it all the time. People look at me like I'm crazy, but you know, what's their names? Jason Service and Navarro. Well, they're going to prison and have never failed a drug test on a racetrack.
It shows you that they were getting away with it.
Right. So you want to back up to where we can only give a horse bute at 48 hours. Well, you're not leveling the playing field. You're making the cheaters have even a bigger
advantage.
Bigger advantage. You know, you take away us that use legal medication. I mean, I've had three high butes since 1998. You know, run 350 horses this meet. You know, and if you take away the therapeutic drugs, you know, these people that make these rules, they get up in the morning and take a couple of Advil. So
get
around.
I take a leave all the time. I feel a little stiffness in the back, I'm topping a leave.
Exactly. And, you know, these animals are now, people don't give them breaks. They're expected to run 12 months out of the year and compete at the highest levels, but have no help. You know, but a football player gets his shoulder injected on Friday to play Sunday. Well, everybody's betting their money on them.
Oh yeah,
you know
they are now. Right?
It's just not fair. I think if they want to improve something, improve the testing and improve the track maintenance. You know, have the tracks at a higher standard, and you know the horses know that's where the injuries come from. But and like I said, it's just such a misconception. I don't do social media because of it. You know, I don't do TikTok or Facebook. I don't do none of that junk. You know, my sons all come to me. And
I'm glad you said that, because that's me.
I don't do it, because my sons, they'll send me, oh, Dad, did you read this? Or I don't want to know.
I even go one better. I got a flip phone still.
I have an iPhone, but I don't do social media at all.
I love it. Shane Wilson's been with us, who won his first training title, and this doesn't mean you're going to go be a jock agent like Fache.
No. I couldn't do that. I couldn't. By the time I got you a workout schedule at 8:30 with Tom Amos on a really good horse, and you decide to go to Bourbon Street and not come to work that morning, that'd be the end of me being there. I would get arrested. I couldn't deal with those guys. But you know, I'm going to train horses as long as somebody will give me a horse to train. That's what we love to do.
And you'll keep clocking them.
I'll keep clocking them in the mornings and watching them in the afternoons. That's the fun part.
Mikey DeLiberto and Shane Wilson. I got Brad Cox. I don't know if you want to sit in on Brad Cox, but I got to call Cox. All right? Well, I can't thank you enough, both of you.
Thanks so much. That was one of my text messages yesterday with Brad Cox. He texted me and said, congratulations. I know you and Connor work so hard. He said, if you need anything in Churchill, let me know. We'll be there for you.
That's good.
That's
Brad,
nice.
Brad's one of the good guys.
No, Brad's a nice guy.
Here, come together and take a picture of the two of you.
Tell him.
You know what? As bad as Brad.
There we go.
As bad as Brad beats you up every day, you'd like to not like him.
Yeah.
But you know what? He's
it's hard not to like
him. He walks by you in the morning, punches you in the shoulder, and tells you congratulations, man, for winning the race. He's like the most normal, nicest guy.
You know what you're asking? Ask him when you talk to Brad about Discreet Mischief. Where's he going to run? He's the one that worked with Catching Freedom 2 weeks ago and worked right with him and actually was a little ahead of him.
Was it? All right. There we go. We're going to find out.
It went really good.
I think you just made somebody mad that was waiting to bet him. right? Exactly.
How about Florent? He didn't ride here Saturday, and me and him was talking on the rail, and I said, where are you going to be Saturday? He goes, I'm going to Oakland.
He was at Oakland, yeah.
He went first mission there. He went the big stake over there.
He said, Shane, I'll win both of those. He said, with Nash and first mission.
Yeah.
He said, and Brad had told me, too, that the – the surface at Gulfstream was so loose and sandy when they went down there and rode. And he said,
Mission didn't like it at all.
He said, if you don't train over it, you can't hardly win over it. It was so loose. And he said, he just didn't get a hold of the track. And he said, but you'll see First Mission this weekend when he shows up at Oakland.
Yeah, Grant, got 100 fire.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Mikey, thank you so much. That was fabulous. And
you need me to stay?
Well, if you want, yeah, you can sit in with you can congratulate Brad yourself because he joins us now. And Brad, you weren't with us, but Shane Wilson is doting on you here and telling you it's hard to be mad when Brad comes and congratulates you or when you beat him.
Yeah, and I had a huge meet down there and. His son Connor did a great job all winter. They make a great team.
Well, we just had we had a couple of hours with Shane here and with Mike Deliberto, and you kind of round things out because what a tremendous weekend! And of course, it wasn't limited to fairgrounds. You also tore it up at Oakland.
Yeah, no, great weekend. Obviously. Very, very good horses and in the right spots. And, it was a good weekend, both tracks, and very proud of what our team was able to put together and what the horses were able to accomplish.
Let's start with the Louisiana Derby. And, you know, I guess there's one school of thought that says just because Catching Freedom and Honor Marie, you know, came running from the back of the pack, that it collapsed, but you know what? The splits weren't. It wasn't a breakneck pace. It was an honest enough pace. But they just, you know, they both moved, and Catching Freedom moved best of all.
Yeah, no, I thought the pace was. I didn't like the setup. We were getting it all turning up the backside. I thought the horses were well bunched. I know we obviously don't run them out in 3/16 there very often. If we do. At any other point during the entire meet, but I thought that the horses on the lead were kind of carving out soft enough fractions. We were part of the New Orleans handicap a couple races prior to the Louisiana Derby, and we were up on a hot pace and with touch upon a star. We had obviously best actor and the 3/8 pole. I thought both horses were kind of. Getting tired, and I actually picked up the winner route one at the 3/8, and I mean, I saw Joel kind of moving him up with the rail, making a steady move, somewhat like Catching Freedom. Obviously, he's a little bit more pace to run into, but yeah, I thought it was a race that kind of set up for a horse that was somewhat close to the lead.
So for the way Catching Freedom and Honor Marie, the way they finished sets up. I would think very positively when you head. You've already headed back. You're back in Louisville, and for Dennis Alba, it's a tremendous win.
Yeah, no, big time win. I mean, obviously those guys have been in a position like this over the last several years with some very, very good horses. They've had with Dell, and we had obviously Angel. Empire last year, so these guys know how to get to the Derby. There's zero doubt about that. They have a good team in place. They do a great job of selecting horses at the sale, yearlings, mostly yearlings, and they've got a very good program that's led them to the Kentucky Derby on several different occasions.
Well, since you mentioned Angel of Empire, he's working his way back, right?
Yep, he's back. He just shipped back to Churchill. He's doing really well, and hopefully we'll get a start team over the next month or so.
No plans or goals in short term?
No particular race picked out. I always like to start him back in the easiest spot I can find. I don't know if there's an allowance race that would make sense. But we'll get a little bit closer, or getting a little further down the line in regards to fitness, and then hopefully something will pop up, maybe at Churchill or even New York, that makes sense for him.
And then before we talk about the Phillies and everything else that went on this weekend, what kind of a schedule, what kind of plan do you have for Catching Freedom between now and Derby?
Just keep you on a steady work pattern every weekend, starting 2 weeks post Louisiana Derby. I kind of do the same thing with most of them. You know, he's not an eye-catching workhorse, so I'm sure a lot of people will watch him leading up to the Derby, and, you know, people that don't know him will probably say he's not working well. But, you know, his last few works have been better than normal, or better than his average work. But he's you know, he knows how to bring it in the afternoon. He's just one of those, he's no different than a basketball player, a baseball player that just, you know, he's not a practice player. But you need him in crunch time, he shows up. So he does things right in the afternoon.
Well, he's the Allen Iverson of the barn. Since you're talking about work and workmates, before Mike Deliberto left, he wanted to know where Discreet Mischief is going to turn up next, because he's been working with him.
He's going to the plan is to run him opening weekend 7/8 at Keeneland.
And just like in what kind of a race?
Amazing.
Okay, I thought he was. Yep. I thought he broke his.
You said Discreet Mischief, correct?
Yes.
Yes. He's amazing. He'll show up at Keeneland's the plan.
Is that the horse that Al is Al in that horse?
No, that's Samaya U.S.
Okay, Samaya, okay. Let's talk about the filly then, and that was a terrific race. Tarifa and Our Pretty Woman, and they basically put on a show.
Yeah. It was too close to the show. I mean, filly on the inside ran a huge race. Our Pretty, she, I didn't know what to expect going into the first turn. She kind of shot away from that horse running up on the outside of her, and cleared off, and she was a little, just a touch rank, but Flavian did a good job of getting her to settle best he could, and, you know, I didn't take too much out of her, obviously. I do think she's going to have to learn to relax a little more. I mean, next time, we're hoping to be running against larger field, obviously, in the Kentucky Oaks, so she's going to have to learn to chill out a little bit, but overall, she got the job done. She's had a great winter at the fairgrounds, and we're hoping that, you know, that path to the Oaks through the fairgrounds has always been, you know, a good one to take, and hopefully she can, you know, add to her name to the list of fillies that's come out there and ran really well or win the Kentucky Oaks.
Well, a busy Saturday, not just here, and I could ask about Best Actor, but let's talk about what went on at Oaklawn and First Mission. You got him back on a faster surface after the struggle over Gulfstream's loose main track, and he looked terrific. Gets his first win as an older horse.
Yeah, we I think, you know, he got some confidence from that weekend. So we've always loved him, but, you know, obviously you have a little bit of a race that you, like you say, draw a line through. You still need to see a good effort from him next time out, and he goes, let's give us some more confidence with him, or restored our confidence with him moving forward with the win. Totally, I don't like making too many excuses, but there's no doubt that just the Gulfstream surface was not his thing. He didn't take to the kickback at all, Louie. He didn't look comfortable with me at any point during the race. So I was glad to get him back in the win column. I thought he broke well and put himself in the race, traveling better there as opposed to Gulfstream. And, you know, we're excited about him the rest of the year. We think he could be a top horse. And I think he showed on Saturday. He's you know, hopefully set up for a big year.
Ali Sheba, Stephen Foster.
I think that Stephen Foster would probably be the short-term goal, or the goal this summer or spring, whatever. But you know, you'd obviously need a run between now and then. The Oakland handicap's probably going to be, I am going to bring him back to Churchill to training. He's going to ship back today. But I think the Oakland handicap's right in play, and the Ali Sheba, I don't think we would do both. But, you know, both races are things we'll look at over the next few weeks.
Very good. And then Nash, and, you know, some people wondered, running Nash in that spot, does it eliminate him from, you know, classic consideration? Do you think he's a cut beneath? Are you just taking your time with him? Where do you stand?
Well, we'll talk it over with Michael Benningham and Dan Pratt. I think we're probably going to keep him at shorter distances for the time being.
Okay.
I'm not certain. We've talked about maybe the Pat Day Miles next spot. Okay. He's never run a bad race. He just never really finished up quite as well as we maybe expected, and we kind of think there could be some, you know, some question mark with how far he wants to go. He trains like a very good horse. I thought he ran a big race the other day, and you know, it's a two-turn mile, and, you know, we'll let him bounce out. He's going to ship back to Churchill as well. But I think right now, doesn't mean something couldn't change. We'll keep him nominated. He can probably nominate him to the Lexington and everything. But right. I think maybe the Pad Day Mile may be the race we're looking at first and foremost.
We'll no, see. and then you can make all kinds of decisions from there. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. First Mission and Nash, both at Oaklawn on Saturday. Quick review of the experience at Turfway. Alpine Princess.
I thought she was getting a good trip. I thought Louie put her in a great position. She kind of her race for the taking there. Just kind of maybe got a little late. You know, we really can't give you much of an excuse. I'm not certain she loved the surface, but you know, overall it was a solid enough effort. We might give her a little bit of a break. She's been on the go pretty much since last spring. Debuted at Saratoga last summer and kind of been pretty steady since. I'm not certain that the Oaks is her thing. I'm not certain she would even get in at this point. I'm not sure where she is. I think she may be inside the top 14. I can't remember what I saw. But, I think right now we obviously have several points races coming up too, so she'd probably get kicked out if she's even in the top 14. But I think overall, I think we might just back off her a little bit and freshen her up.
She's 12th right now.
I thought she was 12th or 13th.
Yeah, 35 points.
Yeah. So, I mean, but with the Gazelle, Bluegrass, Fantasy, with all that being, having not, you know, those are Santa Anita, or yeah, I guess the Santa Anita Oaks as well, I would say there's zero shot of her getting in anyhow.
All right. Well, there's plenty of other opportunities down the road. I'm not going to worry about we'll catch up with Botanical and Chop Chop down the road. Got to ask about 1 3-year-old before we talk about this weekend. Cornishman, who, you know, probably took one extra start to break his maiden than you would have liked.
Yeah, maybe two.
All right.
I liked him a lot first time out. He just didn't get away as well as we have. Now, he's a good colt. We've not really zeroed in on anything with him. He just shipped back to Churchill and come out of his maiden win in good order. You know, we think he's a horse that's definitely going to improve with time. You know, obviously, we're not thinking Kentucky Derby or anything with him. It's a horse that we're going to try to let come along at his pace. So really don't have anything picked out for him yet, but he is back to the track and very happy with the way he's moving. And he's another one we think's got a big future. I think, you know, he put himself in the race the other day when he broke his maiden and stayed on fairly well. And I think, you know, once again, he's one I do think mile and eighth, mile and a quarter type thing down the road. He could be, you know, could be something that he'll thrive at.
This weekend at Oaklawn, the Fantasy and the Arkansas Derby. I'd probably talk to you next Monday. West Omaha and Timberlake, right?
Yeah. No, both are good. I think, you know, we obviously we just need things to go smooth with Timberlake. He thought he drew well enough. He's trained very, very well. I mean, look, it's obviously a deeper group of horses than it was in the Rebel, but I think he's definitely doing every bit as well or even better leading up to this as he was the Rebel. The Rebel, yeah, I didn't really feel like we had him, 100% ready to go. I know we didn't. I don't know what the number is in regards to percentage and ready to go, but he wasn't quite all the way there. He's spot on for this one. He's doing as well as he can do. I think, you know, once again, he's got to get a good trip. He's got to settle going into the first turn and get into his, you know, big stride, big fluid stride, and if he can get in a good rhythm, he should be in a good position turning for home and hopefully kick on.
Well, for those that didn't see it yet, he actually is the 9-5 second choice, which I thought was a little surprising. I think he and Muth is the 8-5, you know, nominal favorite. They'll vie for favoritism. Then there's also Mystic Dan for McPeak, and you've got Just Steel entered back here. Who else that would be considered a major? That's really the four players, more or less, lining up for the Arkansas Derby, and then West Omaha in the Fantasy.
Yeah, we're hoping she get a little bit cleaner run, especially off out of the gate. Last time she got pinched a little bit and kind of got scratched up a little bit. leaving him there and kind of raced in between horses pretty much the whole way. I thought she ran well enough just to stay on to get the placing she did. So, you know, I think she definitely needs a better trip than she got last time. And once again, it's a deeper field than the Honeybee. And she's been training well. We kept her there at Oaklawn. She's had two good works since the Honeybee. And hopefully with a good run, she's right there. A good trip, she's right there.
Brad, got to ask you about a couple of horses that are a little bit out of sight, out of mind. And Just the Touch, you know, had a sea of slop to deal with in the Gotham. And you know, everybody's oohing and aahing over Deterministic. And it feels like they're forgetting about Just the Touch.
Well, they'll remember him when he runs next time. I really believe that. He breathes very, very well at Keeneland this morning. He was right at a minute out, 12 and change. And if he runs the way he works, he'll be tough. He's a good colt. There's a lot of talent there. There's a lot of horse there, bottom line. There's plenty of him. He's a beautiful mover. He's got a great mind. Knockwood does everything right. Planning to look at the bluegrass with him. And probably had one more work prior to the bluegrass, but he really breathes well this morning at Keeneland.
Well, the bluegrass is going to be it's a war before the war. I mean, it's going to be insane.
Yeah, it's going to be a good group. It's obviously a great one now. I think Central Quality helped that happen, and we'll hopefully be a part of. We're also looking to run in Encino there as well.
I was going to ask.
It's three. Yeah, he's won his last. Well, he's made three starts. He's won his last two with a made win in John Battaglia. He worked there on Saturday. Breezed pretty very very well. Breezed very very well and galloped out. It's the first time we'd ever work him on the dirt. He'd turn on the dirt prior to him coming to us, but we want to give him a chance on the dirt. We think that this is going to be a opportunity for him to step up and see if he can compete at that level. But he's a big, good-looking horse that's doing everything right now.
Any other chances in a prep for Lightline and Bergen and Aircav?
Aircav, no. Probably going to cut him back. Bergen, cut him back as well. And Lightline, probably looking at an allowance race for him.
All right, so everybody's going to regroup on that front. And then Saudi Crown cuts back in the Gotham Mile.
Yes, he's doing very well over there. He schooled actually just a little bit ago there in Saudi, or I'm sorry, not Saudi, Dubai. And he's handled everything very well. He's obviously been there since the Saudi Cup. He's been there nearly five, well, it will be 5 weeks this weekend, or four and a half, and he's settled in. It's, been a good winner for him, and hopefully we can continue on Saturday. It's our first runner in Dubai. We've never made a start in Dubai, so looking forward to hopefully having some success.
What's next for Castle Warden and Big To Do?
Castle Warden, probably first level allowance, could come at Oaklawn or Churchill. Big To Do is in, I believe it's Thursday. He just shipped from Fairgrounds to Oaklawn. But yeah, he's in at Oaklawn in a first level allowance for 3-year-olds on the dirt.
And then there was also Miracle Worker.
He's doing well. First level allowance at Oaklawn or Keeneland. He's getting close to being ready to roll.
We're getting ready to roll too, heading to California. And Brad Cox, as always, I appreciate it. Congratulations. Get lucky this weekend.
Thanks, Steve. I sure appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
And Shane Wilson, thank you for a fabulous visit, and thanks
yes,
for
sir.
Coming up here. Outstanding. Continued success. We're going to send it out to everybody. Limited racing today. Parks and Mahoning Valley, Turf Paradise, and what's the fourth? There's a fourth. Will Rogers. There we go. There's your superfecta of racing action. Thanks to Mikey DiLiberto and Shane and Brad Cox. And thanks to everybody at Fairgrounds, Kevin Kilroy and Joe Christofek and the whole team. Love coming here and looking forward already to coming back. Back with you tomorrow from Clocker's Corner in Santa Anita, everybody, for the next couple of weeks. Replay 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM Archive Podcast. Probably a little bit late today, probably 6 o'clock or so when Brian gets back. Casey's off this week, and I'm off to California. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.